This session is called Estrangement from Earth, Lessons from Geology. In a way, this is the second part of what was begun on Monday in a session which I called Living on a Living Planet, Our Geological Origins. I'm going to recap that a little bit, but I want to start off by saying that I've been a geologist for about 15 years. I've been a Lutheran Christian most of my life, all of my life. And I've, like all of you, you reflect on your work, you reflect on your faith, and in reflecting on geology and what I find when I see rocks, when I read about geologic history, it tends to somehow get intertwined with questions and reflections about faith. And so what these presentations are some of the ways those get entwined for me. And I'm a little bit selfish with these meetings because I'm able to come to Holden here and work out some of these ideas a little bit or try them out. So I'm looking for some responses, and I want to know how this stuff hits you, if it hits you in a similar way. Let me recap a little bit what I said last time. The points I wanted to make last time was that, one, the Earth is alive. I like to see the Earth as a living planet. If you've taken a geology course, the word dynamic is heard quite a bit. We, being humans, having a very short lifespan, being very small in the universe, we don't see some of the things that happen, but they are happening continuously. I talked about plate tectonics, continental drift. The Earth is in motion, always has been in motion. This valley was created by glaciers flowing through it. It's continually being changed by the rivers flowing through it, by the wind that blows on it, by the glaciers that still exist here. And, as we can see behind us, also by the works of people. We are geologic agents as well. Geologists think that this particular period of time that we're in, which we call the Quaternary, the last couple million years, is one of the most geologically active or one of the most volcanically active periods in the Earth's past. So not only are all the processes that have ever happened still occurring, but they almost seem to be occurring as fast as they ever have right now. The Earth is a closed system. We get all the material for rocks, for our cells, our bodies, for plants from the Earth. And one of the main images of the Earth being a living organism is cycles. There are geologic cycles. Continents get recycled. Ocean basins get recycled. Water gets recycled. The atoms in our bodies get recycled. Lends new meaning to dust that we have in some of our funeral services. There is a cycling with the Earth. And lately, in the last 10 years or so, we've been hearing about a new hypothesis called the Gaia hypothesis, which even more suggests, not even by analogy, but as a fact, that the Earth is a living organism, that the biota, the ecosystems on the surface of the Earth, control the Earth in some ways, particularly the atmosphere, to make it beneficial for their particular, for that particular ecosystem, that they control it, they buffer that system. So the Earth is operating kind of as one organism. So that's what I wanted to emphasize in that first point of the Earth being alive, by analogy, but also in some senses, literally. The second point I made last Monday was on our geologic origins. The main point here is that we are not a final event on this planet, a dusting of life on this planet after this inorganic revolution took place after billions of years of Earth history. All the activity occurred, and then things stopped, and then God took out his or her magic wand and said, okay, we'll have life on this. We are not separate from that history, but we are a product of that history. Physicists that study cosmology, that study the Big Bang, which they now believe is the way the universe began, at least the story that scientists give, have discovered that there were decisions made in the first milliseconds of the universe, choices made between the structure of matter. What would electrons be like? How big would protons be? What would be the charge of an electron? How fast would light be? All these things that are physical constants now. In the first few milliseconds, those were decided upon, in a sense, or those were chosen in some way. Physicists, in playing with those numbers and those factors, find that if you change the values even very slightly, life as we know it would not exist, would be impossible. There's a narrow window, a narrow set of values that were chosen, and life is possible because of that. The whole range of possibilities other than that, life might not have occurred. Chemists have looked at the nature of atoms and the nature of bonding in atoms, and have found that atoms kind of love each other, that they are, when carbon and hydrogen see each other, you know, it's like love at first sight. The elements that make up our organic molecules wanted to come together, the structure is so simple for them to come together that it was inevitable that they would. It seems to be in the nature of matter itself for life to come about. Okay. Our stuff, our bodies, is Earth stuff. We are stardust, as the song says. Those were the points I wanted to stress on Monday. And what I ended it with was maybe an advertisement for today, saying that there are spiritual consequences to this. And I want these are the things that are maybe a little bit new to you, and I want to have your reactions to them. I don't want you to hear these things as being antithetical to the Bible and the creation story. The point here is not science out to show that the Bible is wrong. This is just, for me, an enlightenment. I mean, that's how it's kind of felt in reflecting on these things, an enlightenment about the nature of the universe, the nature of myself, that's come through the study, my study of geology. And I want to, I've got these, have a bunch of ideas that I had a hard time placing in some kind of sequence. But I did anyway. I want to talk about three different areas where I think there is some spiritual information in all of this. One is in the nature of our connectedness to the earth. The second would be in the nature of our brokenness with this relationship to the earth. Hence the title for this session, Estrangement from the Earth. I like using that theological term. I think we are estranged from the earth in the same way that when we say we are in sin, we are estranged from God. I think the sin, our environmental crises are like sin in our personal relationships. And thirdly, the last thing is our place in geologic history. So let me, I want to get through these so that we can talk about them a little bit. Several points in our nature of our of connectedness to the earth. One is that it makes me feel more earthy. It makes me feel more natural. I like this fact that I am the same stuff. I like looking out at the stars and these mountains around here and feel the power of glaciers and these processes and feel that I am part of that same kind of awesome power in this universe, that I was, I have arisen out of that. We are natural. There's no way around it. So it makes me feel more earthy. Secondly, it makes the earth feel more human to me. If I am the same stuff as the earth, then the earth is kind of the same stuff as me. And rather than going out and, you know, ooh, bugs, and, you know, we look at, I don't know why it was that every fascinating geological feature in the West got attributed to the devil, but we have Devil's Tower, and the first person that saw the Grand Canyon, you know, said this is worthless land, nobody is, I go to those places now, and with these kind of thoughts in mind, and there's a relationship to it. I look at that and see that the similar kind of movement or energy is the same in those things. And I recognize something. I recognize myself in the earth. That there's much less fear. Certainly earthquakes and volcanoes do an amazing amount of destruction. But humans do an amazing amount of destruction to each other as well. This recognition is what makes the earth seem more human to me. The idea of the earth being our mother, Mother Earth, is really clicks in here for me too. You know, you recognize the earth like you recognize your mother. This is where I come from. This is the source of not just in a physical sense. This is where I get my nutrition and I couldn't live without it, but where you get some kind of definition and spiritual sense. Okay, it makes me feel more earthy, makes the earth seem more human. This one's maybe a little bit more controversial, or one that I like to think about. It makes what I already do seem more natural. We do, when people in the environmental movement, when we talk about ecology, there's a lot of people bashing that goes on. I once took a trip with a friend to the Hopi Mesas in northern Arizona. One of my favorite places on the earth, the Colorado Plateau, this red rock country where the Grand Canyon is, and the Navajo reservation is, and the Hopis. Well, I went up to the Hopi Mesas with a friend to see the bean dance, which is kind of like confirmation. It's a dance in which the Hopi boys, in this case, when they're about 13, are taken down to the kiva, and the kachina dancers, who they've seen all their lives, dance for the first time without their masks, and they see that it's their fathers doing this dance. And they're told the story that mankind or their forefathers had sinned, and the Kachinas used to live with them, and now they've gone back to the San Francisco peaks. But if we continue these dances and be faithful to their ideas, perhaps they will come back again. A powerful kind of ceremony. We were on this, in the ancient town of Walpi, where there's no electricity. It was November, it was cold, it was night, and there was smell of pinyon smoke in the air and coal, and we were me and my friend were two of four white people that were down in one of these kivas seeing these dances. I felt kind of out of place, but it was a very powerful experience. And the next day the dances continued, and I was thinking about, this is about 15 years ago, but I was thinking about the connectedness that these people had to this environment. It just seemed to be all of one piece, the buildings, their religion, the earth, and in the environmental movement today there's a lot of revering of that that kind of sensibility. And I remember being kind of not misty-eyed but stirred by all of this, and walking to the edge of one of the mesas and looking down. And here at the bottom of the cliff was a washing machine, a used box of fab, a dead dog, garbage, all this kind of stuff. Obviously, this is where the people had come to the had thrown away. This was their garbage dump. And one response was that, well, you know, these are people; they're just like us. But the other thing, the other way that I chose to respond, or that I like better, is that we are as real on this planet as birds and animals, and there was something very natural about throwing stuff away. Archaeologists have looked through middens in ruins for a long time, where people have thrown stuff away that's unused. And there was something, in a way, in a few moments there, there was something graceful about that landscape with human trash in it. I know that sounds kind of radical and anathema to most environmentalists, but it said, we're legitimate here too, and stuff is thrown away. Obviously, this has gotten out of hand. But I don't want to, just because we throw things away doesn't mean that that it's evil. So in that sense, I want to say that the kinds of things we do, the fact that we build houses, that we build dams, that we use, generate electricity, we're very clever and we have all these tools, that these things too are natural. Birds build nests, beavers build dams, we build houses. We are a creature just like all these others. It makes what we already do seem natural. Fourth point here under the nature of this connectedness of the earth, it, like the confession of sins that we have at the beginning of our worship services, thinking about these things often makes me feel, in a sense, forgiven, or let's say legitimate. I think we are sometimes made to feel guilty that we are humans on this planet, that we're mucking things up. And when I think about our origins, that, and you look at the stars, and this is the same stuff as me, I feel like I am part of this. I'm meant to be here. In the same way that the forgiveness that we feel on Sunday mornings says that we're okay and we're meant to be here in this community, this kind of observation to me makes me feel that we're meant to be here on this planet. Okay. I'm at the end of this first point, nature of connectedness, going on to brokenness. Does anybody have anything they want to say, or any comments or questions? These things are still fuzzy in my mind, and I took, for some reason, took a walk in the moonlight last night, and I'm tired and I'm not.
Well, I like those thoughts, because at breakfast this morning, the Mattins, I just thought, well, what the hell even try for? After there was just some real strong statements about how we're messing things up. And you can hear that so long that you feel guilty for being white, for being, you know, for having trash, having waste material from your body. It's like it's all wrong. But to think of it as part of a cycle makes it easier to recycle, to be more into it.
Robert Pirsig, in his book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, talks about riding across the west and being stirred by that landscape and then going to Crater Lake. And it was just so immaculate. He wished for a Pepsi can, you know, thrown in the woods just to make it seem real.
If we were really, truly to be with nature, a whole village wouldn't be here.
That's actually the point I'm trying to make is that this right here is just as natural as what would you say is more natural, living as pre Iron Age people or something.
It really reversed that it's a geologic occurrence that caused Holden to be here. Without the mineralization in that mountain, Holden would be here. That's the real fact.
We can just stay here. You don't have to worry about the fire.
What does that mean?
Well, it means a smoke detector in some building has gone off, but it's not this one.
So we'll just stay calm and continue talking.
It's Shelly 5, so none of you lives here, so you can just keep on if you can. I guess we can shut the window.
The man who gave himself a tour in a tune with nature is such a comfort and a feeling. And it's wonderful that we can experience that here or almost any place that you select, just to be in solitude and quiet and peace with yourself and the surroundings around you.
I think that's so important. I think you don't have to go to national parks and places like this to do it either. I live in southern Minnesota, which is flat as a pancake, and I think I can be just as stirred by the environment there, the beauty, as anywhere else.
I saw a few places very flat.
Huh.
But deer come and look at me and like I'm invading their territory. And I smile and they accept me.
Let me go on to this next point, and if you have more comments that you want to make on these first things, just hold on to them. Part B, I want to talk about this estrangement or brokenness from this relationship. I wrote some things down, and I'm trying to get them out in a smooth manner here. First, let me say that for whatever reason, we exist in somewhat of a broken relationship. We grow up hearing about man and nature, that we're something different. With our superior minds, our God-given minds, our evolved minds that allow us to reflect on ourselves and on nature, I think we are deluded by the power that gives us, so that we become as gods and think that we are different and above, and we make ourselves above the rest of the earth. I think when we reflect on life and we think about these cycles, what abhors us is that we are part of those cycles, which means we're going to die. I read several years ago a book by a man named Ernst Becker, a book called The Dial of Death, and that much of our, he states in there that much of our character, much of our personality, much of our way of interrelating with people is an elaborate mask to avoid this horrible realization that our death will come. And I think in that vein, we have encouraged this distinction between man and nature, that we are abhorred with our own death and we don't want to see ourselves connected with this earth. So we exist in brokenness out of this, and I think this comes about in a couple different ways. One is more popular than the other, I think, or more common. The one way I like to call that we think of ourselves as kings of creation. And we use the Bible a lot to support this broken view, that God made the planet for us, that it is at our disposal, that we use it in any way possible, that if it means destroying ecosystems to earn a livelihood, that's fine because this is what God has provided for us. I once saw Chuck Colson on I think it was a 700 Club one night, and they were talking about the oil crisis and the diminishing supplies of oils, and he kind of gave this chuckle, and I took offense because he was kind of referring to geologists, and he said, oh, those geologists, you know, the problem with them is that they're not believing Christians and they don't realize that the Lord is going to put more oil in the earth for us. Which kind of Which bothers me because it insults me as a geologist, but it kind of insults reason in general. The same reasoning that makes somebody invent a light bulb or make a toaster work or a car, that same kind of logic and that we respect is the same kind of logic that scientists use to come up with the ideas that they do. I think even the concept that we are stewards of the planet is a little bit pretentious at times and a little bit patronizing. You know, that we are so mighty and powerful, but you know, we're going to care for you, don't worry, you're in our hands. I think that even is a little bit part of this estrangement. So the kings of creation were much better than nature, we're separate than nature. Both of these views say we're separate than nature. One of them says we're better, the other one says we're worse. There's not that many people that believe this, I think, but you hear it occasionally, and it comes out in the on the more left side of things, with the rabid environmentalists, which I am close to being. But sometimes you get the feeling that the very best thing on Earth is the place where there's absolutely no people. That if you go on a wilderness trip and you see another footprint, it's ruined. Your experience is ruined. You know, somebody came in here and mucked up this experience for me. I think that is the same kind of estrangement, that we're differentiating ourselves from nature. And what I want to say is that we're not different. We're as beautiful as soaring hawks, as delicate as flowers, and as wonderful as anything that you can imagine in creation. We're disconnected. How do you get reconnected? Well, we hear plenty of that here at Holden. There's just loads and loads of books in there about this stuff, about finding out a little bit more about our biological or geological connections, the effects of our industry and our lifestyle on the planet. There are many ways that you can... Al Pitcher has all these brochures that up by the bulletin board at this end of the cafeteria that you can take a look at. There's many ways that you can seek to get reconnected. Not the least important, most important, is to get out and enjoy nature itself and experience this kind of connectedness. Okay, so connectedness, brokenness, and just the last few things, which kind of confuse things maybe a little bit, the third section I call Our Place in Geologic History. And these may be a little bit more disturbing than these other ones. One is that I think when you look at geologic time, we are the last instant. There are all kinds of analogies of if geologic time were the height of the Empire State Building, that's how old this analogy is, World Trade Center. If that represented time, we are the coat of paint that's on the ball at the top of the Empire State Building. There's one, I can't remember the... John McPhee came up with this great writer that's kind of gotten bit by the geology bug. We've got one big book by John McPhee here called On the Control of Nature. I can't remember which king it is, but it's the king that... of England that defined what a yard was going to be. And the amount of time, he defined a yard as his arm length, and the amount of time represented by human existence is the amount of fingernail taken off in the swipe of a fingernail file. So we're in the very last instance here, on this planet. It makes me hard to imagine that the Earth was made just for us. If God is all-powerful, you know, why did God wait so long? But this connectedness and this view of the universe as being full of life, predisposed to life, that we've sprung out of that, makes me think that at every point in geologic history, there must have been a wholeness. There must have been an integrity to the the universe at that time. We're still evolving now. We were evolving then. By evolving, I don't mean just biological evolution, but the changes that are recurring in the planet, the changes that are recurring in the universe. That each snapshot in time on the path to where we are now was whole and loved by God. When I was in college, kind of the guru at the time was Buckminster Fuller. If you didn't go around quoting pithy comments by Buckminster Fuller, you just weren't cool. and he had one book called Manual for Spaceship Earth. In the back of that, he had a couple of translations of the Lord's Prayer, which was kind of surprising because he didn't talk about his Christianity in this book very much. But he said every night before he went to bed, he'd repeat the Lord's Prayer, and he would kind of redefine it in his own words. And if you've read Buckminster Fuller, he likes words and long, complicated words. He defined God as the evolutionary integrity unfolder. The campus church I belonged to, I went to Augustana in Rock Island. We had even thought about changing. We didn't. We went through this phase of saying, well, we're kind of a separate church in our names. And that was one of the names that kind of came up with Lutheran Church of the Evolutionary Integrity Unfolder. It didn't get voted in. But I really love that image that God is behind this, is the creative force, and it's evolving, constantly changing, but that at each time, each snapshot, there is an integrity to the whole, evolutionary integrity unfolder, and it's God's energy, God's creative power that is doing this unfolding. If God knows when the sparrow falls, God also knew when the trilobite fell and the brontosaurus fell. Okay. Another point that comes from in this section on our place in geologic history that's kind of disturbing perhaps as well. If you look at latest thought in the way evolutionary biologists think, Stephen Jay Gould, another great writer, they talk that evolution is not progressive. This view of the universe beginning and ready for life and growing into what we are, there can be something appealing in that, well, we're still kind of the best thing that's ever been. You know, we're still at the very height. You know, nobody's ever been quite as smart as we are. And as far as we know, there hasn't been creatures on this planet with our gifts of reflection. But if you look at the nature of the evolutionary record, it is not progressive. Things kind of sputter and move along in a kind of bumpy, chaotic way, and there's no long-term change in the evolutionary system. So it's not progressive. That could be some problems for some people, maybe for myself too. Another problem that comes from the geologic record, and this says something about our place in geologic history. We are finding now that the record of life on this planet is interrupted by periods of mass extinction, where for some reason 50, 70, 90% of all the species living on the planet at that time became wiped out. I should say before I explain what they think that is now, that at the rate that we're killing species due to our activity on this planet, the rate that we're killing species in some cases is faster. If a paleontologist would look at this horizon 10 million years from now and see how many species were lost, he would label this time right now as a mass extinction. Same thing that happened when the dinosaurs were killed off. Well, now what they think caused this, and some of you may know this, it was on the cover of Time magazine, is that there were comets that came down and hit the Earth and wiped out the dinosaurs. You know, the first time this came out, geologists that don't like things catastrophic like that, they dealt with the Bible, and the Bible was catastrophic. You know, we had these floods and all this kind of stuff, and, geology still is reeling a little bit from that, and wanting to say, no, things kind of happen slowly and continuously. So we still have ingrained in this dislike for catastrophic things. But since then, there are all kinds of papers that have come out, lots and lots of evidence that indeed there was a comet or comets that hit the Earth about the time of the end of the dinosaurs. Further evidence shows that not only was that extinction, but other mass extinctions were caused by meteorites hitting the Earth. In fact, they occur very regularly, about once every 30 million years. So we live in a universe, a God-created universe. So what's the question you want to ask? We live in a universe on a planet, this beautiful planet, that's predisposed for life and has all this beauty, that every 30 million years, there's a comet that comes and wipes the slate clean, nearly clean. We're halfway between 30-year periods. About 17 million years off. That also says something about the nature of the universe. And for myself as a geologist, these things don't disturb me. It makes me more awesome. Odd. It makes me more awesome. Never a moonlight walk again. It makes me more awed by who I am and what the universe is like. I would have to say, too, and this comes out of the discussions on Monday, that the thing that this doesn't have for me is, though I feel a great sense of power and inspiration from some of these ideas and from experiences in the wilds. When I'm hurting, when I'm alone, when I need community, this doesn't always do it. This doesn't replace. On Easter morning, when you sing, we sing, Jesus Christ is risen today. You know, I'm up there singing that at the top of my lungs, and that is as important and as true to me as this kind of stuff. Though they might seem to some people antithetical, or at least have some problems. I don't know how to answer that. Somebody asked this question during the last session, and I've been thinking about it the last couple of days, and I don't know how to answer it, except that we've been dealing with a God that's a Trinity for quite a while, a God that has different facets, a God that's Father, a God that's Creator, that's omnipotent, and a God that's sacrificed, Jesus, our Savior, and that's paradoxical in itself. So I guess in my heart, I don't have any struggle between these things. And some people in my head, I do have, well, I don't have a struggle. It's not that big of a problem because it's not a bigger problem in my heart. But now I'm starting to ramble a little bit. So, how does this strike you? What kind of comments does this, what's the verb?
Well, I agree with you. I don't have a lot of struggle. In fact, I love thinking about geologic history and how God must have loved the dinosaurs and how exciting it would have been to be there in the Cretaceous period when flowers, plants evolved, and you know, just and bees and stuff. And the one thing that is sometimes a struggle for me, and I don't know what to think about it, is the idea that and maybe it's not such a law anymore, but when I was taking biology courses millions of years ago, that mutation had to be absolutely random, that it was the combination of random mutation and natural selection. I don't know, and so that question of randomness and how does God feel about randomness and as opposed to causality and that whole business. Do you think about that?
I don't know much about that kind
so
of stuff.
So that things could have turned out so much differently, like you said, with all those things about the speed of light and stuff like that.
Right. And Stephen Jay Gould talks about this, that there are the same kind of seemingly random choices that are made throughout evolution, not just in these physical constants, but things that happen on this planet. I mean, if the comets had missed us, life would probably be different today here. He talks about these strange animals that lived in the Precambrian, that when life was much more diverse than it is now in the early Precambrian, but the nature kind of found out that these models didn't quite work as well as others, and so these models were like Edsel's, were, you know, discarded. And one of them's called the Hallucigenia, because it was such a strange looking animal. Somebody said it looked like, you know, he was hallucinating. Another one was called Wefaxia, and Stephen Jay Gould kind of quips that, you know, had things, we could have easily, instead of doing clam digs on the Atlantic shore, we could have been shucking Wefaxia sclerates on the Atlantic. But he talks about randomness a little bit, and the process that is random is the mutation itself. But what is not random is the context in which that occurs, and that selection still takes place after that. That whatever change that mutation causes in an individual, that it still has to fit in to that ecosystem. It has to still survive in that integrity at that time. And if it doesn't, it doesn't happen. So, I mean, he's had some writings about that. This isn't a problem for him. I guess it's not a big problem for me, but the chanciness, I know that's kind of strange.
Maybe God just wants that.
Yeah.
Do you think that the scientists' theories are changing so rapidly these days that what is, you know, accepted theory today, 10 years from now, will just be old hat? Or?
The rate at which geological theories change is just amazing. The rate at which new ideas come to the fore is dizzying. The amount of information that comes out, the amount of journals that come out, is just incredible. And a lot of the exciting articles are ones where people say, you know, golly, we thought it was this way, and look, it's completely different. But the most important theories, perhaps the truest things, are the things that last the longest. And ideas of evolution, the ideas of the origin of the universe, these things seem to have only, in a way, we've become more sure of them through time. I don't think the theory of evolution will be overchanged. I don't think the theory of plate tectonics will be changed now. I know from the outside it seems like that all of that could, the way scientists talk, the speed at which theories are altered, the kind of things that I'm talking about could change, but you know, I don't think so.
What are some of the theories that are changing? That,
well, the biggest one.
About,
yeah.
You have to talk
simply. The biggest thing is this idea of in the last 25 years of plate tectonics, that the Earth is like an egg with a thin shell, and that thin shell is broken into plates that are continually sliding. And geology before this theory of plate tectonics, these shell pieces are called plates, and their movement is referred to as tectonics. You have to have fancy terms, you know, so you appear to be smarter than you really are. Geologists aren't smarter than anybody else. Before that, all the different subfields of geology, whether you studied fossils, or you studied glaciers, or you studied volcanoes, or earthquakes, all of these things seemed to be kind of on their own, separate. And with plate tectonics, all of this stuff came together. It was a theory that explained everything. Any paper now that's written, I don't care what the geologist is talking about, you can ask a series of why questions. Well, why did that happen here? Why did that happen here? You come to a point where you go, because of plate tectonics. It is revolutionary theory in geology. So that's one big one that's happened in geology. But there really wasn't anything before that that replaced it. There was a need to tie these things together, and we just didn't know enough about it at that time.
If she missed Monday's lecture, could you draw that from the slide, that pictic kind of thing that showed as these come together and force this liquid up through, changing the convolution?
Earth? I can't, this shell is already too thick with this pen. But if we blow that up, the earth is, the shell is, I don't know, it's about 700 kilometers thick. It's called the lithosphere. And these are coated with a couple of different, I call them flavors of crust, the ones that make up the oceans. We just call this ocean crust, and I know I'm writing too small. And this is what is underneath our feet right now, continental crust. These things occur on the Earth's surface in different pieces. It's a very complicated, long theory, and I'm trying to find a way that I can do it fairly quickly. If this is the globe, I could draw several of these plates on the surface, and maybe here is where North America sits. Actually, the San Andreas is one of these boundaries between these broken plates. But it's where these plates jostle against each other that we have volcanoes, where we have earthquakes. The very rock that makes up the ocean basins is born at a spot where two of these plates seem to be moving apart. Iceland happens to be growing in one of those spots. There's a mountain ridge going through the center of the Atlantic Ocean from the North Pole to the South Pole. That's at one of these spots. Magma comes up here. New crust is born here. Like I said Monday, as we speak, there is brand new crust of the Earth being formed right now. As this crystallizes and cools, the movement of the partially molten mantle below the crust drives these two plates apart from each other. And they get bigger and bigger and bigger until we have Atlantic Oceans and Pacific Oceans. Then there's another spot where these things, if they're splitting apart here, they run into each other elsewhere. And let's call this other spot the state of Washington. And let's call this Glacier Peak, and here's Holden Village right here. Where one of these plates meets another plate that's coming this way, and you have a little bit of a car crash. Because this one's heavier, it tends to get drawn back down into the earth where it's melted. The volcanoes that occur here, the lava that's crystallized here, the high temperature and incredible pressure that metamorphizes the rock here. This is where all the continents are made, in these kind of positions. So once you talk about the rock that makes up the continents and the rock that makes up the ocean basins, and you explain that the ocean basins form here and the continents form here, it kind of explains the rest of the Earth. It's a beautiful theory. I mean, geologists just love it. It just explains all kinds of things.
And it's a closed system, just like you were talking about. It comes out here and it disappears down here.
This stuff gets remelted back down here. There's some problems in actually figuring out how that happens, but there are earthquakes that occur here. When you look at a map and look at, people know how deep earthquakes occur. Here they occur fairly shallow. Here they occur deep. You can see that on the Earth's surface. You can see this descending plate on the Earth's surface. They stop about 700 kilometers below the Earth's surface. Why? Well, they think at that point you don't have earthquakes because the rock's not brittle to break anymore. It's been melted. So that's what happens. Anyway, that's brand new. Since 62, 63, that's when all this stuff was happening. And now it's taken as kind of gospel by geologists. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yes?
Your title was Estrangement from the Earth, and your second point here about the brokenness. Could you comment more, maybe we shouldn't feel superior, maybe we should, feel as servants or whatever it is, but at least to some degree, the reason for the disappearance of some of these species is not just, comets or something. I mean, it's, we're responsible, or at least it seems to me that somehow that we are responsible for some of the dramatic changes that are occurring here, and therefore if we're responsible, if it's our brokenness, somehow we have a responsibility to do something about it in a positive sense of trying to help at least slow down some of these processes, even if we can't control them all.
I say amen to that. What I want to avoid is when, and there's lots of people that are talking about that here, and lots of books that talk about how we can repair the earth and change our lifestyles. It is an undeniable fact that our present lifestyle, our consumptive society, is wreaking havoc on the rest of the planet, and we're causing extinctions. And we have to do something about that. We have the power to do something about that. But the reason I'm making these points here is that I don't want it to make us feel bad because we can't work ecologically with the rest of the planet. Doesn't mean we're bad or wrong. I could talk for another hour about ways that we can help to repair it. So your point is, I totally agree with that.
As long as you have as many polluters of people, there is really a losing battle, it seems to me, to reverse the thing to the point that we will be better off than before we came along the way. Mm-hmm. The ecosystem was in more harmony, maybe.
Well, I think one other hazard is trying to go back to a time when things were more pristine, and we kind of idolized the noble savage, and if we all looked like Indians, it would all be better. Well, I don't agree with that. I think the only way to go is towards the future. There are things that we have created that I don't think we can live without now, and things that I think are improvements in our society. To do the kind of changes that we need, I don't think we have to diminish the benefits that we enjoy right now. I highly recommend a book called The State of the Earth, put out by World Watch and Lester Brown. The last chapter in there, he talks about a vision of the future, what it would be like. And there is no way that we're going to compromise the quality of our food, the quality of our homes, in fact, all of these things should improve. We don't have to retrench to a time when things were well. We had it great back then in the 80s and the 90s, but we were kind of wrong, so we have to suffer with this more mundane future. I don't think that's going to happen. I think there are ways that we can do what we want and have fulfilling lives and still be ecologically sound.
Do you think the Earth can sustain 8 billion people?
I read a book once that said France was overpopulated in the 15th century, that there were too many people they didn't have enough resources at that time to support those people, and there was a lot of starvation. I'm not sure what the limit is for people. It seems to me that population is an obvious problem, and right now it's a major stress on the ecosystems. I guess I don't know enough about that.
Question over here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't part of the Gaia hypothesis that since humanity is just a part of the Earth, that that we're not really, we may be stressing ecosystems, but we're only catalyzing change that's going to affect us, and life is going to survive no matter what we do. It's going to evolve and change into something else. It's humanity that we're playing.
I think that's a good point. And that reminds me of something else. All this, this is Rick's Rick Dunning's idea too. We were talking about this the other day, that it kind of grates against me a little bit when you hear all this talk about saving the planet. I mean, what we're really talking about is saving ourselves. That if what I say is true here, if we even, and this was a bright ray of hope for me a few years ago when everybody was worried about nuclear catastrophe, you know, what an awful thing to wipe out every living being on the planet. But the power is in the universe, and it would continue on. If we have an ecological disaster and all humans vanish from the surface of the Earth, this would still continue on. There's some, and the same kind of positive nature to the universe and the life would come back. It would, and it would be beautiful, and there'd be other animals and other mountains and stuff, and it would still be good.
So it's us that we have, if something is going to change, it's humans' concern for our own condition now that will dictate, you know, whether we make a change. It should be not the environmental movement, but the human movement can save the human race.
I like that. That's good.
What does dominion mean to you then, as Christian geologists?
I think it means understanding these relationships and understanding how I impact in these cycles. If I am taking more than I'm putting back, or if I'm putting back more than the earth can take, then I am I'm out of balance, and I need to get back on balance. Dominion means balance, I think.
Are we more responsible for the
Yes, I think so, because we're more responsible for the destruction that's going on. Yeah, Barb.
Well, I wanted to respond to what you said here. I think that sometimes that Gaia fatalism, or whatever you want to call it, almost sounds to me like sort of James Watt warmed over, only a different version. And James Watt was Reagan's Secretary of the Interior, said, well, what's the use of caring about the planet anyway, because the end of the world is coming. We know that from the book of Revelation. And I think that is as bad. I mean, that's terrible, that kind of fatalism of just thinking, oh, well, you know, what's another planet, you know, kind of thing. And I guess I have to say in response to that I think part of sort of the sense of history of geology that I love is, yes, indeed, there have been so many moments in the history of the planet, and those moments will continue. But I am placed in this moment in the planet's history, and I have a calling, as does each of us, to care and to become involved and to take our moment in history really seriously. Not that the dinosaurs moment wasn't a serious one too, or the other periods of time, and not that the Earth isn't a planet that will continue, but that of sort of really seeing ourselves as having a calling in this particular moment, in this incredible age, is really important too. I guess I don't want to see a sense of Gaia fatalism either. And so that's my response. Now I wanted to follow up with a question to you, Mark, of if you ran a congregation, or how would you like to see us take this back in our churches, for example? It sounds like you are a really active Christian and a really active geologist. If you had the sort of adult education program in your church to set up, or more than that, not just education, sort of the activities center to set up, but what should we be doing in our congregations to respond to some of these, both the exciting ideas in science and the challenge of the environment in this moment?
I think you kind of have to attack it from all fronts. I mean, it's one thing to talk about these kind of things, which are kind of high-minded and lofty, perhaps, and disturbing, but I think it doesn't take some kind of conversion experience to know that our lifestyle is a little bit out of balance. And the thing that I really like about the environmental movement, and the thing that would be easy to do in churches, is there's so many simple, little, tangible things that one can do to begin actually doing something that at the same time sensitizes you to the problems. Recycling, I know churches that have stopped using styrofoam cups, start using mugs that they bring themselves, or you decide to wash them afterwards. You can carpool to church and these kind of things. There's a whole range from the hands-on simple things that you could do to discussing maybe more things like this.
Well, how about at the sort of higher, this more philosophical level, would you teach evolution? Would you talk about this earth spirituality?
I'm not soft pedaling this when I say this, but one thing I like to say, and I said last Monday, is that this is still a story. This is a story that's come out of our mindset of this particular time and age, and we're scientific people, even if you say you don't like scientists, or you don't like science. I mean, we're in a rational age, and if you apply that reason and ration to observations that you make, you come up with a story like this, but it still is I like to see it as a story, and Genesis is a story too that has, I would say, probably maybe it had as much meaning for people then as this kind of stuff has for me right now, but that our context has changed. I'm not a pastor. As a member of a congregation, I would not feel hesitant to talk about this stuff. And I know there's people that have problems with evolution, but to me, this makes me believe in God. This kind of stuff, and Genesis doesn't do it. I was rambling.
Seems to me that's the least threatening place to start would be with the. Children in the Sunday school or the teenagers or something, because they're still intellectually curious and they don't have their minds set as much as the older people do, and then just let it work on up.
And the biggest question is not whether this is right or whether Genesis is right. I mean, the more important questions are our ecologic connections and the things that we're doing to destroy the environment and our sense of wonder with the planet and those kinds of things.